come on in. I'm Janet Elber. I'm the Principal Arts Consultant for the Dana Foundation. And I'm going to start with a little bit of information about our specific arts education funding and then turn it over to my colleagues for more about our arts and cognition study. The Dana Foundation has been in existence since about 1950, funding health and education. And about 5 years ago, they asked me to come in and help them with broadening their education funding into arts education. And at the time, I was given instructions that we were going to start with dipping our toe in. And I suggested that the foundation might want to look at doing research in arts education, and they weren't particularly interested in that, or perhaps in the areas of advocacy, and they weren't particularly interested in that. And we finally settled on teacher training and trying to influence the quality of the arts in the public schools, K through 12, by supporting curricula for artists who work in the schools and for in-school arts specialists. So we've spent the last 5 years really carving out that very particular area of funding in arts education, and feel that it's been it's a pivotal piece of the puzzle. I know in yesterday's arts education session there was a lot of talk about systems and how the different funders interfaced or how our funding affect the systems. And I think in terms of Dana's funding, we run the gamut. We have funded some very small organizations, a small dance company in Brooklyn that is in five or six schools who needed the money to work with their particular artists on their particular methodology. And we also fund the professional development that's a piece of the Arts for All blueprint here in Los Angeles County, which is, of course, the macro of that. Through the Armory and through the Music Center, training both the artists and arts administrators in the various aspects needed to be more successful in school residencies. Along with this growing, we got in up to our knees very quickly, and now maybe you're up to our hips. I'm not sure. The foundation already had in place a system for their health funding, in particular their brain research and their public awareness campaign for that support. The Dana Press already existed, and radio programs for that funding. So the arts education funding was very quickly supported with this system that was already in place. And we hosted a symposium with a resulting publication, Planning an Arts-Centered School. We did several radio programs and were able to support our funding in sort of this larger capacity. In fact, tomorrow we'll be hosting a gathering of our Los Angeles region grantees to be able to discuss issues that might be particular to this region, and they can be a support system for each other. And we have some of our publications over on the table if you'd like to take them home with you. As our work in arts education grew, it became clear that the Dana Foundation realized that we were on a collision course with the call for better research in the areas of the brain and how the arts may influence the brain. A little over a year ago, decided, as well as our arts education funding, to support a study in this area. And my immediate reaction was, oh, great, finally, they're really going to prove what we all know. You know, we know the arts make you better at math and a great reader and change the economy of your hometown and make you smarter and braver and more wonderful. But then the artist in me said, now, wait a minute, we have to appreciate the arts because they are the arts. They don't need to prove anything else. So, and I heard some of this yesterday also in the arts education. Some of that, why can't we, what the gifts of the muse say, just talk about those intrinsic values? We need new language for the intrinsic values. And then someone else said, no, wait a minute, I'll take whatever values they've got. You know, whatever convinces people that the arts are important, let's go for it, whether it's the economy or math or whatever. I think one of the other things I've learned working for a foundation that is information once we get it. And I encourage you in the question and answer about how it is going. You maybe talk more about this, Mike. The idea that the research might be influenced by our enthusiasm for using it in a particular way is maybe not the best way to approach it. I'm going to introduce. Hyde persona. He's here today as Dr. Jekyll. So this is William Safire.
I should say that Janet Elber here, many of you might know her as one of the great modern dancers of our time at the Martha Graham Company. And she has just become the artistic director of the Martha Graham Center. At the same time, she continues as our principal arts consultant. We try to spot them early and bring them along. We started out calling on Janet to find that niche, that special niche that one foundation can do that isn't just tossing money at a general subject, but can try to really zero in on one important thing. And that's what Janet has led us into. The training of professional artists to go into public schools in three discrete areas, in Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and New York, and see if it works. Well, we started out with $250,000 a year 4 years ago. It's now the budget for us to do this is $1.25 million. That doesn't sound like a lot of money, but it's a fast rate of growth. It is growing. We are now next year going into the rural areas and seeing where we can do through the Kennedy Center and Lincoln Center and several other organizations to get us out into the hubs to get this training into local schools. We're also looking into how we can use the internet to help move this along. The Dana Foundation primary identification has always been education for 50 years, and you run into Dana auditoria all over the country. And the Dana Center in Austin, Texas, was very innovative in advanced educational techniques. But then, about 15 years ago, we went full bore into neuroscience. Our previous chairman, David Mahoney, felt that this was the decade of the brain, and the federal government's promotion of the decade of the brain, frankly, was falling on its face. And he got together with James Watson, the co-discoverer of DNA, and with that imprimatur, or imprimatur, as some of you might prefer, they got together the leading neuroscientists in the country, and then later in the world, to start the Dana Alliance for Brain Initiatives, which has been booming along. And then a few years ago, thanks partly to Janet's nudging, we thought to ourselves, here we are in the field of neuroscience, the brain, and here we are in the field of education. And doesn't education and the brain sort of fit together? And then we went to the father of cognitive neuroscience, Professor Michael Gazzaniga at Dartmouth University, Dartmouth College. Put it to him. I was in politics. I am no longer in politics. I'm a language columnist now for the New York Times. But I recognized that accountability was the big thing in education. And that's why math and science and reading was taking a big boost, because it's easily measurable, and thereby you can say, well, you see, our students are doing this much better, and we should get funding. At the same time, the arts are the first thing to be cut in any budget cutting, and they have been cut. And so it occurred to me that if educators could show that there is rigorous research that buttresses the idea of the arts help the brain develop, then all of a sudden accountability becomes something working for the arts and education instead of against it. And it happens that this is a moment in the development of neuroscience with the remarkable new imaging techniques that allow us to look inside the brain. And this is the time to launch such a much talked about but never done extensive longitudinal study. So we went to Dr. Gazzaniga and said, are there any other great scientists in this field? He has a network, because he is indeed the father of cognitive neuroscience, which is the study of how the brain, he'll tell you what it means. and he reached out to five other universities where the, frankly, some of his acolytes and students have made a name for themselves, Stanford, University of California, Michigan, Harvard. I always think of Harvard last. got them together early last year. We're in the middle of this study right now. They are working together, these six universities, to determine whether a study of dance and drama and music, the performing arts, actually have an effect on young people's brains, and the effect that might be transferable to other school, other portions of education. Just as children who are brought up in bilingual families, their brains have a special edge that enables them to do other things. So we turn to Dr. Gazzaniga. He's in the middle of this three-year study with the five universities. He is familiar to those of you who are in this area, because not only does he have a home in Santa Barbara and travels here often, but he is leaving Dartmouth to come to the University of California at Santa Barbara full-time to head up the new Mind Institute at UC Santa Barbara, which will be, frankly, the center of cognitive neuroscience in the world.
Thanks, Bill. It's really great to be here. Pasadena, I was probably the only person in this room born in California. And there's a few more good. I was born in Glendale and had the deep pleasure of doing my graduate work at Caltech, so I know this town, and it's just a wonderful place and great to be here. I'm heading this consortium up, and it's really quite odd because I neither dance nor sing nor act nor paint, but there's a lot of it in my family. And the idea behind this program is that if I had somehow taken the time to learn one of those skills, I tried the piano. I was asked not to play it by my mother. I tried singing. I was asked not to show up at the choir performance in high school. I remember that because where the microphone was fell right in front of me, and I was so bad. So I want to see the result of the study, because if it turns out there is a payoff for early arts training on cognition, then I can sit and ponder the rest of my life what I could have been. So that's something worth keeping in mind. And so really, this all started, as you heard, with the Dana Foundation and growing out of the education program. And the longer version of the whole description can be found in this booklet that the foundation has put out. And I recommend that you get it from their website. And here's the essential question, just to say it. So there is lots of information already in the world that, you know, through studies that have been done throughout the world, that there is a high correlation between children who take on arts training of some form, whether it's music or dance or acting or what have you, and those children turn out to also do better academically. And it's very true in lower socioeconomic classes that this correlation holds. It's a very robust correlation. So the question is, though, is it causal? Is it a real causal relationship, or is it simply the fact that kids who decide to build into their schedule a practice of something, doing something, that is already a kid that's smarter, that wants to build in and manage their day to perform academically as well? So there's nothing that's just a correlation. There's no real causal. And so the objective of this research project that the Dana Foundation has is to see if there's a causal relationship, because if it turns out there is, then there's a real capacity to represent the power of the arts during development and during particular times in development, and how that will pay off for the child. So the Dana idea here was they did their background deliberations and basic research. They found out these sort of baseline points. They tested the idea with outside advisors. The consideration from a proposal then where I was interactive at that point, and we used a strategy that can be used. It's not used that often, but I think it's a good strategy, and that is, I went to eight of the leaders in the brain and behavior business, the cognitive neuroscience business, who had not worked on the problem, but I knew them as senior people, smart as hell, and they know how to go about getting answers to questions. And so we tapped those eight people. They thought about it. Were they interested? And then they wrote how they would attack it. We put this together into a proposal. The Dana Foundation approved it. And we're now in the funding and monitoring it. We're having our first meeting next week, where the first year and a half of work will be reported and the groundwork laid for the next year and a half. And the idea is, and we don't know the answer yet, but we're seeing signs of some of the answers, and they look quite encouraging. But the idea then is to lay out the story with the scientific background announced from people who don't have an axe to grind. These eight scientists weren't in the business of music in the brain or art in the brain or whatever. They were really, they did other things. And if they come out and say, this is an important area that we should consider, it will have large impact, I think, in the scientific and educational. And then, of course, that should set the groundwork for major funding to really push the idea home, and the funding that will far go beyond the capacity of one foundation to carry it out. So the schools are, as they mentioned, were Berkeley, Dartmouth, Harvard, Michigan, University of Oregon, and Stanford, and the people at each of these institutions are outstanding, and we'll find out how they're doing. And this is the idea that I'm going to give this idea sort of three times, so you just kind of know what's at stake here. The issue is, when somebody reveals themselves they have talent, is it a mixture of heredity? Is there a critical period during their development? It's a concept called the critical period between the ages of 4 and 9, when if information is taught to people of a particular kind, it has an enhancing effect on either a specific way you can learn something or on a more general way. So to give you an example, one that's been worked out is perfect pitch. So some musicians have perfect pitch, some musicians don't. And it really doesn't interfere with their or necessarily assist them in their playing of the piano or the horn or whatever you, whatever. But we now know that in order to develop perfect pitch, you have to have a genetic disposition to it. You have to be musically trained, and the musical training has to occur between the ages of 4 and 7. If that doesn't happen, you will never develop perfect pitch. So the controls are obvious that musical training doesn't start to the age of 8, and the person turns out to be a terrific pianist. They never develop perfect pitch because you miss the combination of genes, timing, and training. And that idea is the idea that we'll keep returning to see how effective this arts training is. Is it going to have that same story, that there's a genetic, there's a timing, and there's an entire concert going on in Bill's pocket? So the control, just to show you, it's one thing to say that you have that learning to paint is going to help you, but you also have to just ask the question: is any activity? So what kids are learning is that if they take on a sport or an arts, they're really learning to manage their time. They're learning to the day has to be scheduled. There are extra things you have to do. Is there something unique for arts that helps academics versus just learning how to start to schedule your life? And all those controls will be run by our study. And one of the centers already has put out a paper where it's very I won't go into it because it's not directly related, but it shows that attention training during a critical period in the development of children has a major payoff in their ability to acquire information later on in life. So, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? What I want to do for the rest of the time now, because I've teased you with what the team is out there doing, and next year we'll know, we'll have a solid sense of advances. But let me tell you what we know about becoming an expert. And it gives you a framework for understanding what the results might be. And it's a fascinating story. When you're looking at how you become experts, it's people think, experts are born, experts are trained. It's a combination of genetics and being trained and timing. Those are the issues that we want to unpack. And there's no question. Everybody knows that if you practice some skill, you get better at the skill. There's no question about that. The question is, if you practice a specific skill, does that transfer to a more general realm of academic and scholarly capacities, more general cognitive skills? That's the question that we're after. Well, let's look at what we know about becoming an expert. And I get to have a little fun. This is, see if any of you recognize this little tune. I'll tell you the story behind it. You know what that is? Oh, you missed out. That's the overture to the Full Monty. I know about this because my son-in-law was the bass player for this musical, which was written by a guy named David Yazbek. And they were students at Brown together. And David became an expert, as we say. He wrote the words and the music, which means he got 2 points from the Broadway experience, and that means his salary went from $400 a week to $66,000. So there's real payoff in becoming an expert, as you can see. And the interesting thing there's something to what is called the 20-year rule. I was once in a conversation with a set of writers, one of which was Tom Wolfe, and we were discussing the role of language and writing and of the objective knowledge of language and of the science of language and knowledge and writing. As the conversation went on, he made just the general point that, well, no one should show anything they write till they've practiced for 20 years. And everybody around the table wanted to pull back a bunch of stuff that was already written and out there. But it turns out, if you listen to Yazbek's story, and this man is a true musical genius, he did 20 years of hard work. 20 years of hard work. And literally, if you listen to the rhythms from this musical, there were things that he sat in Central Park for hours upon hours learning these combinations of rhythms from the musicians. And he can't read a word of music. Another interesting thing. So he finally writes a score. There's some guy sitting behind him madly transcribing the thing so that it can be written and the rest of bands can play the music. So there's something about experts that's always fascinated, and the question is, what is it? Are they born with a specific skill, or is it just through training, just sheer force of will and training? And I'm going to start off by saying that there are many psychologists who believe you don't need the genetic aspect at all, that you can get it all through training. And the quote I like to use is from my colleague Rich Ivory up at UC Berkeley, who's a terrific psychologist and a believer in training. And as he says, the study of eminent performers across many careers leads to a startling conclusion. Elite performers result from intense, demanding practice, and those who excel are more willing than their peers to engage creativity in this regimen for countless hours. It is their drive that produces talent. If young Michael Jordan's interest had been taken up with physics at a young age, I have little doubt he would have succeeded admirably in that field. A Nobel Prize might have been in the alternative to his 6 championship trophies. Now, people just are astounded that there are people who actually think that through hard work and training, I'm not going to worry. Give me a normal brain, give me whatever range of intelligence, and then start the training process that sort of skill can emerge. And there are people who say the observation is confounded upon, maybe he started at a higher rate and the training shaped that higher capacity, that innate capacity, obviously to a higher level. And so that's what people, to some extent, are trying to study. We do know some things. So we do know that in many elite athletes basically are freaks. They do things that have capacities, oxygen exchange rates, for example, that are higher than normal. Here's my favorite. This is the super tasters. You know, there's a group of people that get to be super tasters. And it turns out they have more taste buds on their tongue. They're just born with them than the normal person. And it turns out women have far more taste buds on their tongue than men, even though most chefs are men. This doesn't make any sense, but it does suggest that expensive meal being bought for a woman pays off because they actually can taste it. And you can actually see, if you put a little blue food dye in your tongue, you could check out whether your spouse is a super taster or not. But anyway, I don't want to waste the money. Go to Big Mac. Don't worry about the test. You know. Anyway, very basic point that there are variations in capacities that they're just there. You come from the factory of these things, and these may be biasing you into certain skills. And in the physiology realm, like I mentioned, it's the rate of exchange of oxygen and muscle tissue. And most of us practice hard, and our rate of exchange is around 53. And we get to 80% of 53. But the elite athletes get to 80% of 80. Their baseline is higher. And the really super elite athletes have even higher base rate of 85 as the number on the exchange rate. So you just can't fight that. That's just they can replenish their energy level, as it were, in their muscular or somatic sense of faster than the next guy. And then the special anatomy that occurs in some swimmers, where the way their shoulders are, Mark Spitz, the way his shoulders were built, he just would give greater torque every time he took a stroke. And Indurain and other major cyclists have a you're supposed to have a 1-to-1 ratio on your two bones in your leg, and they have a 1.1-to-1, which means that every time they take a stroke, they get more torque out of the bike and so forth. So those little edges, as I say, could be behind that little thing that makes them really super superstars, and that's just part of the variation of the somatic system, and they get to cash in on it. And what about heritability from terms of brain point of view? There are, in looking at monozygotic twin studies, there's evidence that musicality and as I said, perfect pitch has an heritable quality. So that means there's something in the brain that is set that enables this higher performance. And we know from just taking studies of pictures of cross-section of the human brain. This is a cross-section of monozygotic twins, and you can just see looking across how similar this structure here is. It's called the corpus callosum. It's the thing that connects the left brain and the right brain. And you can just see how similar they are, and then you can see how much it varies going up and down, and that's the individual variation between people. So when you combine that with some new studies that have been done here at UCLA, our TOGAS crowd, where they look at the similarity and differences in metabolic areas of monozygotic twins versus dizygotic twins, you find out that their whole blood supply and regional maps are much more similar than unrelated. And that, again, adds credibility to the fact that there are variations in brain structure that could underlie the well-known commonalities in twins. Now, all of that stands the emerging data that shows the variation in brain structures that may relate to various capacities flies in the face of some remarkable clinical examples that make some people think that a skill like music is really a very, what they call, domain-specific capacity. There's a little something in the brain that allows you to become a musician or an artist or something. And it isn't involving a large network and the result of a general learning course. And an example can come from a patient like the one you'll see here who is retarded, is hemiparalytic, is blind. I mean, talk about three strikes against you, and somehow learned to play the piano. And listen to this to make my point. He learns he can only use one hand. Is truly truly retarded and can't add 2 + 2, but it turns out has a huge repertoire of musical skills. Now, so does that mean it's just some genetic thing happens that develops some circuits somewhere in your brain that just makes you capable and it's rather insular to the general cognitive learning that you're experiencing in life? That view, I don't think it's held widely, but it is held by many people. And this is the reason to go through this is that these are the issues that are out there. We want to start building strong empirical support for what is the case in arts training and how it works in the brain and what its larger impact may be. So we know things that mental capacities vary. We know that there's faster neural response times in people who are a little brighter than others. We know that some people have a different glucose metabolism. We know some people have a large working memory. Large working memory, that's the memory where you're trying to remember 3 or 4 things, and some people have a nerve-wracking capacity to remember 5, you know, like kill them. And as you bumble along with 4, and that sort of thing. So, but all of this is in the service of something. all this is in the service of learning, becoming an expert at anything is the learning is to get the process to be automatic, to get it out of conscious experience, to get it so that you can just do it and not think about it. And we have these automatic mechanisms built into us all the time. And here's one that, just to show you an automatic mechanism, there's nothing you can do about it. You have this ability. Right now, you look at that picture. This is a famous illusion developed by Roger Shepard. That table is longer than... That's too bad. That's kind of really... I love this demonstration because there we go. So you look at that, and it's no question the table on the left looks like it's a different size and shape than the one on the right, and yet if you do this, you will see that it's the same size. This is a great illusion to put into a textbook because the students just don't believe it, so they cut the book up, and reducing its value so second sales are better. So there's a reason why we know what part of the brain does that now. It's in your temporal lobe, your ventral visual pathway, and there's a whole explanation for why we get tricked into thinking that thing looks. You can't shake it. I don't care how much college you went to, you can't shake that effect. So that's built in. That's an automatic process. But we forget that we spend most of our life learning skills and getting them so we get them out of our consciousness. And here's a colleague of mine who studies motor learning, and he's trying to see the progression of his son's ability to tie his shoe. And you see his little sister there, so you messed up. So there's the whole training thing going on there. But you're trying to practice that to get it out of consciousness. And all of you probably in the room type, right? You know, we all type all day long in this crazy world we live in. And if I say to you, where's the L? There it is. No, it's over here. Where is it? You get confused. And yet, it's in your brain. It's automatic. You pushed it out of your conscious awareness in becoming an expert. And that's what a lot of training is. Even in the world of learning language, if I put your head in a scanner and I look at your reaction time to learning, if I give you a word to learn to say a verb, to generate a verb that's associated with the word, you get faster and faster and faster at it. And just leave it off. You get so before when you were just starting in such an experiment and you were unpracticed in this verb generation task, they call it, your left frontal area is real active. You're just trying to get these verbs generated to the spoken word to you. And then after you become a whiz at it, that part of your brain doesn't activate at all. It's just you got it out. It's going on automatically. And then you throw in a new task and bingo, that part of the brain comes up again. And you got to start over and learn the new tasks, but then you want to get it out of consciousness. And by getting it out of consciousness, you get it out of metabolic detection because it's becoming automatic. And they do studies on people like the cigar rollers in Cuba. This guy's been rolling cigars, I think, for 24 years, and he's getting better. He's still getting better. So our capacity for practice and its effect on the domain in question is clear. The brain's getting better at it. Your hands are getting better at it. And if you do the studies within, say, musical training, this is a study from the UK where you look at where they rank order children who throughout their development as to what skill they are in music, and you actually look at the number of cumulative hours that they practice, the best piano players practice more. But the best piano players don't just sit down and play that stuff. They work at it longer hours than the person that's not quite as good. And for you sports fans, there's a in the practice business, once you actually realize the importance of practice for a specific skill, then you have to learn there's certain tricks that psychologists have learned about it. And one is that you don't just practice like in hitting. You don't just practice hitting fastballs. Now, this is what most baseball coaches do, and they make a big mistake. They say, okay, Harry, you're going to practice hitting fastballs today. And so the pitcher throws 100 fastballs, and by the end of practice, Harry's hitting those fastballs out of the ballpark, right? He's just getting the timing down and everything. But what happens the next day to Harry is that fastballs are mixed in with curveballs, dropper balls, and everything else, and actually his performance is impaired. He should have been practicing in the context of how you're going to actually play, and you should be practicing hitting curveballs, fastballs, and everything else. But the coaches don't see that because they don't see the improved performance on the first day. And yet, if you do it that way, you have the payoff on the second day. So these are all just some of the tricks of getting automatic, getting something out of consciousness. Another one that is not generally understood is that by rehearsing in your mind an activity, it actually improves performance on that activity. So in this study, one can actually go out and reach for this dowel so your thumb is next to the pink end of it. And the thing varies from trial to trial. And when you do that, you see a MR, a picture of what parts of the brain are involved in this. And you learn that and you get that baseline. And then you say, okay, don't actually go out and pick up the dowel. Just imagine you're doing it and take a brain image. Turns out, as you'll see here, the same parts of the brain are active that are active when you actually do it. So there are now studies that where you imagine doing a particular act, you imagine playing squash, you imagine playing tennis. They actually, that act transfers and it helps you on the actual skill. And finally, just to make a point that once you get skilled at something, whether it's sports or a musical entity, a musical skill or an artistic skill of some form, it really messes it up to think about it. And everybody knows this, but it can be demonstrated in the simplest experiment. So if I just give you I flash a light at you and you have to hit a button as soon as you see the light, you score about 220 milliseconds it takes you on the average to hit this button. Now if I say to you, okay, now, you know, just try to slow down a little bit, you know, try to do 240, 250, something like that. Well, now you're consciously thinking about this whole act. And it turns out your reaction time jumps up to about 500, 600 milliseconds. You can't. You've introduced the conscious loop to the activity. So, well, you know, what is most coaching and sports? It's don't think about it, do it. I'm told it's the same is true in music and other highly skilled fields. If you start thinking about it, you'll get all messed up. Your timing goes off and all the rest of it. You want this out of your consciousness and automatic. And that is the paper that serves as the transition to the final section here, which is this point about absolute pitch that I mentioned. That is a question of genes, training, and critical periods coming together to allow for a skill. We know that goes on in the absolute pitch. Is it going to go on for the arts in general? And here is a little pause that and fun. It gives me a chance to show off my daughter. And that's also my son there. This is a 3 or 4 year old video. And they're playing at one of my other daughter's weddings. And the two guys in the back are professional musicians. And one of them is a teacher. The guy there on the sax is a teacher. And he can't stop teaching. You'll see him here in the video. He just is correcting. Hey, it's a party for my daughter, you know, his sister, right? Taps him on the shoulder and says, oh, you know, get back there. And then you'll see my daughter, who's more musically advanced and plays the sax and piano and steel drum and learned early and is becoming a geneticist. So she actually fulfills the story. But just here's the role of genes teaching and practice. And let's just watch this for a minute and have some fun.